Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate.
Freedom!
This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli and Tim Maurer.
And this is Drew Tignanelli here at Money, Riches, and Wealth. And Timothy J. Maurer is in the house. TJ?
It sounds so official when you say it that way. TJ, you know, I can handle that. I can handle that nickname. My dad used to call me that when I was younger.
How about Timmy?
I prefer not that one, Drew. Yeah, but thank you for reminding me.
That's the one I call you most of the time. But anyway, I'll try TJ for a while and see if I can...
Timmy's just a little belittling. Maybe just it's the way it sounds coming off.
I call my brother Jimmy, and I call my other brother Billy. You know,
and other brother Daryl.
And they're both older than me. You know, so Jim's turning 60, and I can still call him Jimmy, and Billy's turning 58, and
so
I still
should
call
see
him
it as
Billy.
A term of endearment.
Yeah,
then.
I should look at it as a term of endearment. There
sure.
you go, Tim.
Sure.
Thank
Do you have
you.
A Drew's Views for us this evening, Drew, before we get to our fantastic guest?
Yeah, excuse me, I didn't hit my cough button.
No, well,
You know, I have a Drew's View, but I'm gonna have to hold it until next week because
it's extensive.
It would probably take about four or five minutes to go through, but I can give you the gist of it as the Drew View.
Oh, great,
Drew's
great.
View.
I'll take the gist.
Hey, don't rush me here, Tim.
Right.
Anyway, the gist of it is that a listener of ours, his name is Nick. Nick writes in and says, you know, hey, you're always bashing annuities. You know, matter of fact, you just heard a commercial for an annuity.
It's possible, Drew.
Yeah. You know, they give you this bonus and all these guarantees and everything. And he says, you're always bashing them, but one thing you don't do is what if you've bought one and you realize now that, hey, I made a mistake. I want to get out.
And
he says, what do you do? What are your options? And I wrote him back a two-point option, you know, reason, what you have to be wary of and how you deal with warning number one issue and part B, you know, or number two, the other issue you have to be worried about.
Yep.
One's taxes from the government point of view, and the other is the surrender fees and the features that you've already paid for.
Right.
And now you don't want to cut off your nose to spite your face. I love that statement.
It's
you
a
know?
Good
That's
statement.
That's a great concept. Anyway.
Prefer that to the forest for the trees?
Yeah. And,
Me too.
And so I wrote this full one-page email back on what to do with those, and I think that this would be very helpful for other people who may have purchased a new one. And, you know, the funny thing is that we have the ability, as fee-only advisors, to buy no-commission, fee-only annuities with all the bells and whistles no surrender charges, lower fees than normal, and we still don't use them very often at all.
Yeah.
So, you know.
But we'll talk about
times. We're
going to
talk about that
sense,
next
we'll
week.
Talk,
right now, we got a great guest, and we want to get right into it.
Would you like me to introduce him, Drew?
Yeah, I guess that's a good start.
I'd be happy to. Lawrence Cunningham is the Henry St. George Tucker III Research Professor at George Washington University Law School and Director of GW's Center for Law, Economics, and Finance in New York. Cunningham is the author of numerous books, including the one we'll be discussing tonight, The Essays of Warren Buffett, Lessons for Corporate America. Cunningham's research appears in leading university journals, including those published by Columbia, Cornell, Harvard, Michigan, Vanderbilt, and Virginia. His op-eds have run in the Baltimore Sun, the Financial Times, the National Law Journal, the New York Daily News, and the New York Times. He blogs at Concurring Opinions. Larry, thank you for joining us tonight.
Pleasure to be here, Drew and Tim.
Hey, Larry, you have a blog called Concurring Opinions. Is that right?
Yes, it's my blog along with six of my friends.
Yeah?
Group blog.
So how do they get on it? Do they just Google Concurring Opinions or?
That should take you right there. It's concurringopinions.com. So that Google should land on that page, should give you access to it pretty quickly.
So the Essays of Warren Buffett, okay, and obviously you've been a longtime shareholder of Berkshire Hathaway, if I understand correctly, right?
I bought stock in Berkshire, I think, in 1997.
Oh, so that's a good time, 15 years, 16 years, yeah. And it's done extremely well for you during that period of time, actually. Did you buy the B shares when they just first came out?
Yeah, I bought the B shares. I think they were approved at the meeting in 1995 or 1996.
Yes. So you started to buy them in 97, and the A shares are the ones that sell for like $100,000+.
Never split, right?
You know, and the B shares are ones that started out at what was it, Larry? At about $30 a share, $40, $50
yeah,
a share.
Yeah, they split. I mean, he had never split the stock. You know, under the theory that
the A share stock.
Point to it, and you know, people were long-term owners. That, but then some investment banks had started to create clones of the stock, and that tended to create more activity than there's a little bit of artificial activity. So,
sure.
And it earned a lot of fees for those guys. So Munger actually had the idea to split the stock, just the Class B, 30 for one. And so for a while, I forget the exact price, but yeah, it was something like it was the A was trading at 1,000 and the B was trading at a 30th of that.
70 or
and
eight, right.
Then they split it again when they just about 3 years ago, they split the B's again when Berkshire acquired
Burlington Northern
Santa Fe,
right,
to make some of their little shareholders happy. So the A shares, yeah, they trade at some 120,000 or 160,000 or something like that.
Yep. And the B shares trade at about 110, right? Something
right,
like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Larry, here's the thing. We got a break coming up in about a minute or two. But you're a shareholder. You go to the big shareholder
annual meeting,
and it's a big meeting, and it's kind of like going to college, right? It's kind of like a combination of an incredible education lesson and an incredible party at the same time.
That's a great description. Yeah, I was there this weekend. I've been to a bunch of them over the years.
And so you
and,
had
yeah,
a good
you
time?
You learn a lot, and you catch up with old friends and meet new ones. It's a really wonderful and special experience, unlike any other corporate shareholder meeting I've ever ever.
You know, they own a steakhouse out there, right? And they have this big steak meeting dinner, right?
There are a bunch of steakhouses in town. He's got his favorites, and people tend to flock to them.
I thought Berkshire actually owns one of them, don't they?
They own a jewelry store.
I thought they owned one of the steakhouses.
I don't, not that I know of.
Okay, well, you may know better. But then they own Tiffany, right?
They own Borsheim's.
Borsheim's, right, that's right.
Of Tiffany. Both of them are hot, you know, sort of high-end jewelers. Borsheim's, I think, tries to sell a little bit more competitively than Tiffany, a little without some of the glitz and glamour. But
and they give you some discounts when you're on at this big party shareholder meeting, right?
Yeah, we had a 25% discount, and bought my wife a really nice ring and Mother's Day.
Nice work, Larry. Good thinking.
Good thinking. And,
yeah.
And
very good price.
And then there's the furniture store, Bumpkins, I believe it's called.
Yeah, Rose Bumpkin was the person who owned it for many
years. She just finally passed away. I thought she was going to live forever. What was she, about 101?
Yeah, she was like 90, 101 or something like that. And it's called Nebraska Furniture Mart, and it's a big seller locally but also across the country. Very good stuff, solid.
That's a great story of how Warren ended up buying that from Mrs. Bumpkin. You know, it's a fascinating story. Anyway, Larry, we got to take a break, and then we're going to get into some serious stuff when we come back. Right now, I got to go to Terry Troye in traffic. We'll be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
You can always tell when Noah's out of ideas.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
One of the Drew Tignanelli three.
There you go.
Top three.
There you go. All right, Larry, let's start with your book, The Essays of Warren Buffett. So, in essence, what you've done in this book is you've taken like 30 or more years, probably more years, of the letters that Warren Buffett has written to the shareholders, where he's always doing an educational lesson, and you take the point, and then you take different letters and throw them together in one combined essay that makes the point more coherent or more
cohesive. Yeah,
cohesive. Good. Yeah, good stuff. What do you think, Larry? Is that what you did?
That's exactly what I did. Thanks for the description. Yeah, when you do it that way, you discover some surprising pieces of the philosophy, that the way it all fits together and the way the themes connect. And, you know, it's certainly possible to sit down and read all 800 pages in chronological order, but then it's just hard to keep track of for lots of people, and there's a lot of things that just are extraneous and you know don't fit in with the main themes. And so putting it together this way, I think helped a lot of people get the points more clearly.
Yeah, like for example, you talk about Warren Buffett's investment approach, and you know he used a double barrel approach, which he considers pays off handsomely. What do you mean by the what did he mean by the double barreled approach?
Well, he prefers Berkshire to acquire 100% of companies if they can. If they can find, you know, Benjamin Moore Paints or Seasons.
Or Bumpkin Nebraska.
Or Furniture Mart.
Right.
They'd rather own 100% of the company, and that's one technique. The other is if they can't find those kinds of private opportunities, they will buy small blocks of publicly traded companies. And that's what he means by.
I would never call them small blocks. Nothing they do is small.
Yeah, in the old days they were small. They're bigger, but compared to like the outright acquisitions, I mean, they're 3, 5, 7% or something like that in percentage terms.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, like for example, is IBM holding 6%? But 6% of IBM is a lot of money.
Right.
Yeah. Small in relative terms.
So that's what he means. He's looking for, well, what is the things that, you know, that Warren looks for in a stock? You know, you do a great essay on that. There's a few things that he looks for. What are they?
Yeah, well, the most important thing is that the company is so well run and has some sort of distinct competitive advantage. He calls this a moat, using the imagery from a castle, competitive advantage that enables a company to deliver steady earnings year after year. So patented technology, brand loyalty, you know, market leadership, that kind of thing. And that's the most important thing that he looks for. And then having managers who he likes, trusts, and admires who are able to run the business and deliver those earnings year after year.
So one of the things that I've heard Warren say before is that show me a bad company run by bad people and it's going to go out of business in a few years. Show me a good company run by bad people and it's going to go out of business about 10 years. Show me a good company run by bad people going to go out of business about 10 years. Show me a good company run by good people and it'll last forever. You ever heard him say that?
That's a nice quip. Yeah, I think it captures a big part of the philosophy. And you know, the key thing is good, right? You want this company that has you know, good earnings, steady earnings year in and year out, and protected by a moat, and you know, run by high quality people. And the consequence of that, it's interesting because they have now acquired 80 subsidiaries, and some of those subsidiaries in turn own dozens or more other subsidiaries. There are 300 different operating companies within Berkshire Hathaway, and so it surprised a lot of people to realize that they nevertheless have a distinctive Berkshire Hathaway culture, even though they're in different industries, acquired at different times, operating in different regions. And what they have in common is this sense that it's a good company run by good people.
Yeah.
And you know, with 300,000 employees across those 300 or so subsidiaries, they all nevertheless have this sort of quality about them that makes the, you know, that defines a Berkshire company and makes for a Berkshire culture. It's a phenomenal achievement that they've made in creating this conglomerate that nevertheless has a distinctive culture.
Larry, you know, one of the things I love about the book and the work that you've done here is a lot of people will take Buffett's quotes and quips out of context to make whatever point they want to make. Everybody knows Warren Buffett's kind of thought of as gold in the investment world, right? So you've got people on all sides of the investment universe saying Warren Buffett supports us. Warren Buffett supports us because of this, what he said. How would you describe some of the fundamental elements of Warren Buffett's approach to investing?
Yeah, I mean, it is a complicated, you know, I mean, elaborated thing. I mean, it's traditionally characterized as, you know, value investing, mm-hmm. which is, you know, essentially trying to use a disciplined approach to concentrate on businesses where you have some competence through experience or training, and then studying their economic characteristics to ascertain, you know, the advantages we just talked about of earning stability and good management, and then that can be bought for a reasonable price. And so it's a sort of disciplined art. And I agree with your point that, you know, that people do find it tempting to, to quote Warren or suggest that his approach matches theirs or that he endorses it and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine because he certainly has a lot of good homespun quips and they are sprinkled throughout the essays. But I do think it's important to take the whole package, you know, together and to really think systematically. And so, you know, this notion of value investing, I've just sort of summarized it pretty briefly. I mean, it can be boiled down to a common sense proposition like, you know, buy low or buy at a price less than value, but it's a little thicker than that, and it's worth spending some time reading through the essays to develop a sense of what it really all means.
Sure.
You know, one of the principles in financial planning that I, you know, rail against to some degree is they always say you've got to diversify. You've got to diversify. You got to put, you know, you can't keep all your money in one company, et cetera. But Warren Buffett has kept all of his eggs in one bucket. It seems to work for him pretty well. And he talks about, you talk about that in your essays.
Yeah, well, I quote Mark Twain from Pudd'nhead Wilson, who said, you can keep all your eggs in one basket so long as you watch the basket. And, you know, it's a good point. I think, you know, and you're more experienced at you know, financial planning for other people than I am, but I understand that a common advisory tidbit is to diversify. And yeah, maybe that works for some people some of the time. Maybe index funds are a terrific part of a retirement plan and so on, but it shouldn't be seen as mandatory or inevitable. There are certainly approaches, people, and contexts in which focused investing, concentrated investing makes sense. And, you know, in the case of Buffett, he certainly has got virtually all of his net worth has always been in Berkshire Hathaway. The caveat there, of course, is that, well, you know, Berkshire itself has, over especially the last 15 years, become a very diversified conglomerate. But still, there it is. He's got, you know, if something happened to Berkshire, that would happen directly to him. So he doesn't have a lot of offsetting positions. And I agree with you that if any given person thinking about the degree to which they ought to be concentrated or diverse, they ought to think about it rather than just automatically assume that a particular approach is the best for them.
You have to keep in mind, Larry, there is an economic bias of financial advisors to tell people to diversify.
Sure.
You know, if you stay concentrated, it's going to be hard to make commissions on that money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Timothy. Do you have something you were going to ask?
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, we've got some new things coming out of the most recent meeting that are really floating to the top. What are some of those issues, Larry, that we should be looking at?
Well, I think the most significant is the question of succession, or Berkshire after Buffett.
Mm-hmm.
That topic was broached a few different ways, by a few different people at the meeting. And my, you know, it's a fair question, something that we all ought to ask. That it was, after all, Warren Buffett is a distinctive personality. He grew this company, he put his stamp on it, and he is the go-to person for a lot of these things. That is, businesses who are thinking about selling think Warren Buffett. They don't always think Berkshire. Companies in financial distress like Goldman Sachs think Warren Buffett, not necessarily Berkshire. And so people are asking, well, we'll be the same company after Buffett leaves. And, you know, he's 83 years old, and so it's a legitimate question. But what is extraordinary is that he has built a company that I think is bigger than the man. So I think the company will endure beyond him, and it's precisely because they have assembled a diverse group of businesses, but that share this common Berkshire cultural
mm-hmm.
characteristic, that they're well-run companies with a protective moat. And they have developed this cultural definition of, you know, a Berkshire company. I think it's larger than the individual. So, and, you know, there are more details in the book that show that what you've got here is a really impressive company, not just a distinctive individual.
Now, Larry, we've heard that your PR person told us that you were going to, first time publicly on media, release the name of the successor to Warren Buffett.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Larry knows.
That's great. I love my PR person.
Yeah, yeah.
She's very good. She
my listeners have been waiting for 3 weeks.
Yeah,
that's why we invited you on the show, Larry.
Yeah, so some guy named Tim, some other guy named Drew.
Yeah, right. There you go.
Two guys in
there. Hold on, Larry. Well, you can think about whether you're going to reveal the name when we come back. And right now I'm going to Terry Troy in traffic.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
What is that?
I don't know. It sounds kind of cool. I like the drum beat.
Oh, well.
I'm down with it, Drew.
Very good, Noah. Steve McQueen.
By
I thought
Joe
he was
Brown.
An actor.
No, no, no. He is. I think the song's called Steve McQueen.
There you go. Anyway, we're here with Larry Cunningham. We're talking about the essays of Warren Buffett. And Larry has refused to disclose the name of Warren's successor. So we're going to move on from there.
Yeah.
And blew the whole opportunity.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, maybe next time, Drew.
Anyway, I got to put
We do know that Howard Buffett will be the non-executive chairman of the board, which I think is an interesting thing, right? And he's sort of there to carry on the family tradition, you know, be the guardian of the culture, as it were. I think that's a known fact, right?
But that's one of the questions that I had for you, Larry. Talk to us a little bit about his son and his involvement. Is that token involvement, or is he genuinely the torchbearer?
And is he the only child? There's two others. Another brother, Peter. He's an actor or Broadway or something. And then there's a daughter, right?
Yeah, Susan. Yeah, I know all three of them. They're all terrific. And no, Howard is a businessman. I mean, he's a gentleman farmer. He ran his own farm. He runs his own business. He's a solid guy. He's got the exact same values as Dad has. And frugal, focused, understands Berkshire, understands the good company, good person concept we were talking about. And he's been on the board for a long time, so he knows all of the big strategic challenges and things that have come along. So it's not token at all. I think he's going to be a very good contributor. This was a question asked at the meeting this weekend, and the questioner was Doug Cass, who was brought in as the contrarian, the bear on Berkshire. And he asked that question. He asked it in a very pointed way. I thought it was a little too pointed for my taste, but Warren handled it well. And he stressed that this is not an operational position. It's not a managerial position. It's an oversight position. It's a position that will contribute, a sense of the culture, the tradition, that sort of aspect. So I think that'll be important. And then on the investment side, we all know I promoted Todd Coombs and Ted Wessler to manage big chunks of money. I met Todd this weekend too. I think he's a first class guy, solid, salt of the earth type, the kind of guy you'd expect Buffett to like, the kind of guy you'd be happy to have your daughter marry. So, the CEO side, I'm sorry I can't disclose it, but they have lined up quite a few solid guys, the chairman of some of the operating companies of the railroad, of Mid-Western Energy. So Tony Nicely from Geico, Ajit Jain, who I also know, who's run the reinsurance business. I mean, and these guys are all really solid first-class managers. So, and again, their role is going to be relatively limited, because an important feature of all these companies that they come with management, with good management, and then those good managers make all the decisions, right? It's a very decentralized operation. So, the new person coming in, it's got big shoes to fill in terms of Warren, but the actual daily routine is not overwhelming, it's not overbearing, and so I think these guys, there's a real good bench from which to draw on that. So sorry, I can't tell you exactly who it is.
Ah, come on, Larry, we're going to call your publicist up and say, we're very sorry that he wouldn't reveal what he said he was going to do.
Yeah, the millions of dollars that we paid Larry to join us, we're going to have to take that back.
Yeah, anyway, we'll go on to another topic, though, Larry. Here it is, okay? So Warren Buffett buys Berkshire Hathaway, which is a textile company out of North Carolina. And it's going downhill because it's so much cheaper to produce textiles overseas, and our country's getting more and more into free trade. And he holds on to it much longer than anyone else. And this is an actual philosophy of his that he will endure for the sake of the people. He won't make a decision just because it's more money for him, will he?
Exactly. I mean, that's a great example. So he finally did have to close that plant down because it was such a dog. But he's never sold any one of the subsidiaries that they've acquired over the last 20, 30 years. There have been 80 acquisitions or something like that. And all those companies are still there. And part of it is because of the screening up front, that they're all, very solid companies, good earnings, good managers. But occasionally some of them hit difficulty, like the Omaha Herald Tribune, newspaper industry,
sure,
having great difficulties, but he rides it out. He will not sell a company just to make a quick buck. And there are many reasons for that. They include the commitment that they all make in the beginning to this Berkshire culture, that we're all in this together for the long term, and we're not into quick buck artistry. That's not the style here. And so, and that commitment helps to secure the Berkshire culture, helps also to make Berkshire the buyer of choice. When a company decides it's time to sell, they know if they sell to Berkshire, the employees will be protected, that it's not going to be a turnaround, a quick buck operation like conglomerates often traditionally would buy a company and then fix it up a little bit and sell it, make a quick buck. And often
or rip it apart and fire a bunch of employees. That's what Mitt Romney was accused of in the presidential election. Is that what Bain did many times? So, but there's a lot of companies that Berkshire owns that most of our listeners probably don't even know. They're going to a Berkshire company like Dairy Queen.
Yeah, bought that about 12 years ago or so.
Fruit of the Loom.
Yep.
Drew, hold on. Let's talk more about Dairy Queen.
Dairy Queen.
The Blizzard,
you know?
Right? Yeah, who wouldn't want Dairy Queen?
Or chili dogs.
Yeah, right. They're two specialties.
You know, but he owns a lot of little companies that most people don't know. Mary Sue Candy. I don't know that a lot of East Coast people know what Mary Sue Candies are. Do you like Mary Sue Candy?
Amazing,
Mary
amazing,
Sue Easter Egg. Come on.
No, I said that Sue's Candies, not Mary Sue. That wrong, didn't I, Larry?
See's Candies. See's.
Jeez.
Yeah. I was getting close.
Yeah, close enough.
I was getting closer every time I tried.
But you've heard of like Acme Brick, Justin Boots. They own an oil company. They own a private jet company. They just bought we talked about Borsheim's, the jewelry company. They own Flight Safety, which trains pilots in aviation principles. The Furniture Mart we talked about.
They own a company that makes boots for firemen.
Yeah, that's right.
I can't remember its name.
The name, but yeah, boots for firemen. They own Geico too. That's a big one. The area.
Yeah, that's not a name we like around here. But yeah,
oh, you don't? Okay.
I've not been a fond of the company Geico. I don't.
Okay.
That's okay. You know, I'm just not fond of them. I can't help it. You know?
Right.
I'm being honest, Noah.
He's always honest.
Yeah, these 80 subsidiaries, they're all distinctive companies, and they have really strong brand names. And it is true that a lot of people don't know that they're owned by Berkshire. I mean, until the last 10 years, I mean, Berkshire was not at all a household name, and I think it has become one, or is becoming one now. But that's just in the last 10 years. It's a 40-year-old company.
Yeah. Larry, we're going to be headed into our last quarter in a second, but before we do, I have my friend Timmy here, TJ. TJ,
whatever
has something
you want to call
that
me,
we
Drew.
Need to know before we go.
Indeed I do, Drew. Tonight, you need to know that Mom's financial advice should not be ignored. Even if Mom is the household member least interested in asset allocation, insurance deductibles, and itemized deductions, and she's not always, it's vitally important to include Mom's non-financial thoughts in financial decisions. Here are three areas of personal finance where a mom's stereotypical instincts are especially valuable, if not vital. Number one, insurance. Guys have earned the stereotype for having a higher tolerance for risk and a lower tolerance for paying for that which doesn't feature high-definition pixels, buttons, wheels, or triggers. We also occasionally struggle to admit when we made mistakes, so paying for something that is intended to protect us from mistakes may seem like wasted money. I'm not going to die, our house isn't going to burn down, and I'm not going to have a car accident. So let's use that insurance premium money to buy a jet ski. Yes, even if Mom doesn't know how to read an actuarial table, her instinct to protect the homestead and its inhabitants from harm is a good one. Of course, we still want to view insurance through the eyes of a risk manager, not a collector of insurance policies for every known fear. But Mom's sixth sense brings a healthy balance to insurance decisions. Number two, investing. Here again, Dad stereotypically makes investing decisions by focusing on that which gives the best opportunity for return, downplaying the inherent likelihood that the stock or fund with the greatest potential for return may also possess the highest probability of loss. But woe to the man who ignores Mom's gut feeling to make capital preservation a higher priority in the handling of the family nest egg. The world's best investors, like Warren Buffett, focus more on risk than return. And finally, number three, nurturing. Financial planning is a process, not a product. And much like moms are often the parent most attuned to the nuanced evolution of their offspring, from newborn to adult, a mother's nurturing instincts are well suited to seeing that the financial planning process has a forward-thinking trajectory. While dads are stereotypically project-oriented, occasionally spending weeks, months, or even years in a special place called oblivion, moms are often best suited to get the myriad of financial to-dos produced in a plan checked off. It's rare that we'd range as far as household finances to find affirming words for moms on Mother's Day, especially when considering the plethora of other tangible and intangible benefits they bring to our families. But financial planning is yet another important subject in which a mom's innate maternal instincts should be recognized and heeded. And that is something you need to know.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
I think he redeemed himself. He got Warren's brother to come on and do a song.
Well, except this is actually a elevator music version of Warren's brother.
Brother. A bluegrass tribute. There we go. All right, Noah. All right, so...
Close enough, Drew.
It's an elevator Jimmy Buffett song.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're here with Larry Cunningham. We're talking about the essays of Warren Buffett. And Larry, my question in this last quarter hour is page 221. And you say in one of your essays that Warren Buffett's approach toward risk and risk management is what he calls the bird in the hand versus two in the bush, which in essence, if I understood it correctly, is the bird in the hand is the Treasury bill. The Treasury bill is yielding 2%, let's say. That's what you can get absolutely safe and guaranteed. And then the two in the bush is any other investment, and what's the likelihood that he's got at least two in the bush and maybe a lot more. And it's that probability is his determination of risk, whereas a lot of the financial services industry has seemed to turn more toward volatility as opposed to probability. Do I got that anywhere close to right?
You got it spot on. Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's
that's an English term, spot on.
Spot on.
Yes, you're not English, are you, Larry?
Yeah, the essay there is called the Aesop, you know, the great, I guess it goes back even further to 600 B.C.
Yeah.
So I'm in that classical frame of mind, but
mm-hmm.
that's the style of instruction that are just throughout these essays, you know. It's a fairly simple, I mean, the underlying ideas are, like, super complicated, but he makes them quite simple, and you've just, you know, passed that on, and I do agree that at least a lot of people in the financial services industry tend to focus on volatility as a measure of risk rather than simple calculation of timing and realization of when and how many birds will emerge. And, you know, that's the kind of hard-headed analysis that you have to go through in order to value businesses and this, to be able to select stocks or businesses to invest in.
Larry, I wanted to ask you to start summing this up for us. What would be the most important lesson that you feel shines through all of Warren Buffett's essays that he's trying to pass on?
Yeah, I think the thing it boils down to, if we wanted to do that, would be that there's a difference between price and value. That price is what you get, price is what you pay, and value is what you get. And, you know, speaking of financial experts, a whole school of financial economists over the last 30 or 40 years have developed a hypothesis that at least for actively traded stocks in public capital markets, that there's no difference or very scant difference between price and value, that the market is very good at digesting information and producing a price that is the very best estimate of value. No one could make a better estimate. And
mm-hmm.
I think at the heart of his thinking, a lot of other ideas follow from it, but the heart of his thinking is skepticism about that. It may be true for some companies some of the time. It may be true over long periods of time, but there are very many occasions on which there's a big difference between the price of a stock and the value of the underlying business it represents. And so I think that price-value difference is probably the the animating, the radiating theme driving through this whole entire philosophy.
One of the other principles that, you know, you also see throughout his essays is the concept of philanthropy. Wouldn't you say that, you know, obviously he's, from a financial point of view, he's the greatest philanthropist that our country has ever seen?
Yes. Well, I think certainly he is going to give away virtually his entire net worth, and has already begun to do so in the last five or seven years, and transferring all of that to the Gates Foundation and others. Well, on that point too, I think the company has stood for philanthropy for decades, and they used to have this great program where, you know, at most companies the boards just decide what charities to give to, and boards are allowed to do that. At Berkshire they did it differently. They basically said the board would decide how much money the company should give to charity, but then all the shareholders got to pick which charities. And it was a great program. It was went on for 20 or so years. It was finally canceled amid some political controversy that some groups didn't like what other groups were giving, and so they decided to disband the whole thing. But it was a neat expression of the sort of the corporate, you know, a rich, profitable company like that ought to be giving back, and that shareholders ought to be the guys making the decision about where the money goes.
That was a tax argument, right? They were trying to make against them.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was something about that. The other thing that happened, it was a political controversy over abortion, and the proponents of the free choice people didn't like the pro-life people, and one of the subsidiaries, the Pampered Chef, I think the CEO, got caught in the middle of it.
That's another name that they own that you don't think of. Pampered Chef is owned by Berkshire Hathaway.
Hard to believe.
Yeah.
I'm still not a fan. Anyway. Larry, real quickly, lest we deify him, one of the things that Buffett has been criticized for over the course of the last 4 or 5 years is getting too politically active. Do you think he's taken his eye off the ball when it comes to the management of Berkshire and maybe, you know, skewed?
He and Charlie jousted at the meeting this year on that, right, Larry?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting.
Munger's pro-Republican and Buffett's pro-Democrat.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, they've jousted privately about those kinds of things for years. I mean, and it's certainly true. He has, become elevated to a different status in the public sphere. He's a celebrity no longer just an investor manager. And that has led him to articulate and pontificate and so on. Not everyone likes that or agrees with it. And, you know, obviously he's got to do what he wants. My own sense is that, and I don't agree with him on a lot of those things, but my own sense is that what it takes to run Berkshire as a CEO is barely a full-time job. I mean, it's, you know, all the operating companies make all the decisions on their own in terms of how to manage the business, operations, strategy, and all that stuff. You know, he has to make capital allocation decisions, which are very important. I'm not denying that, but they don't take enormous amounts of time. So I think, you know, he's got the time to do it. I don't think it distracts at all from the business decisions, you know, what he's paid to do at Berkshire.
Right.
What does it hurt the company? You know, and I don't think it hurts the company at all. I mean, if you don't agree with his position on taxes or gender or whatever, I don't think people are going to be influenced to help or hurt Berkshire or any of this.
I think he's just getting old enough. He doesn't too much care anymore what people think.
Maybe he's thinking, you know what, I should say some, you know, I've got the soapbox. Maybe I'll lay out some things, the broader things that I believe in.
Sure.
So,
well, Larry,
I mean, I take all, that's one thing, I leave out all of those kinds of things from the essays. I mean, to the extent there are those kinds of things in any of the letters, I've left them out, any of those sorts of political things. I just talk about, I just leave in and organize, you know, things about governance, investing, mergers and acquisitions, you know, very sort of solid sort of business philosophy.
Larry, I think you did a great job. The book, Essays of Warren Buffett with Larry Cunningham, and I really appreciate your time here, Larry. It was great.
It was a pleasure being with you guys.
All right. Well, anyway, Timmy, do we have anything coming up next week?
Open show, Drew.
Anyway, this is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.
Talk Radio 680 WCBM.